What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Maxwell Greenberg, exploring Jewish Latino identity in Mexico and borderlands. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and our Shinshiniot Young Representatives of Israel, Rotem Rappaport, and Ron Benicote. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I've been thinking about blessings this week, in part because the Torah portion last Shabbat, Naso, included the greatest of all Jewish blessings, the Birkat Kohanim, the priestly blessing used so frequently at Jewish ceremonial occasions. How many times have you been in a service or at a life cycle celebration and heard the officiant intone or chant or sing, "May God bless you and keep you"? The interesting question for me is just what is a blessing, really, in today's world? At its most basic level, a blessing is a kind of gift conveyed by one person to another. We use this colloquially to mean anything good that happens to us, or even a person who helps us. My mother's nurse is a true blessing, or that child is a blessing to us. But in its most typical, pure, narrow form, a blessing is a way to convey divine favor from the giver to the recipient. When one person blesses another, he or she is passing on something that is in actuality not really his or hers to give. The one giving the blessing is a kind of conduit for God. When you give a blessing, you are conveying a gift from God to another person. In Jewish tradition, blessings can and often are given by a parent to a child. Each Friday night at the Shabbat table, fathers and mothers bless their children using a formula that goes back millennia. May God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. May God make you like Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah. And some parents then add the priestly blessing. May God bless you and keep you. May God's presence illuminate you and be kind to you. May God's presence turn to you and give you peace. This is generally experienced, I think, as a form of parental love being conveyed, rather than an actual gift of divine favor. Dad or mom is showing how much they care for the child, placing a hand on his or her head, touching them, offering a wish for goodness for them. In other words, it's a lovely gesture, a beautiful one, sweet, caring, nurturing. But I'm not sure how many Jewish parents or children think that something from God is being directly conveyed. I mean, in my experience, very few Jewish children think their parents are God, and none at all after about age 5. But what are we to make rationally of the public offering of blessing by a religious leader who is not our parent? The idea that one person, any person, has the capacity to bring special favor to us through his or her personal action, which is the idea behind priest, rabbi, or minister giving a blessing, well, it seems archaic, out of date. There was certainly a time when the common understanding was that a person who held a ritual role literally brought God's presence to the person being blessed. But in today's world, when religious training is essentially academic, learn the content of some books, listen to lectures, study a subject, demonstrate proficiency, the notion that there's something mystically powerful that the representative of a religious tradition alone can convey, well, that appears to be a relic of a bygone age. Frankly, it's a little bit of arrogance on the part of the clergy person doing the blessing. It's as if to say, only I can give this blessing from God to you. And yet, I recall a fundraising event at a congregation I was serving. It was the standard sort of function put together for such purposes by synagogues and other organizations. A prominent person is going to be honored. His or her friends are asked to donate to a tribute book and host tables for a significant amount of money. Funds are raised for the charitable organization. This program included a video tribute to the person and his accomplishments, speeches by community leaders and family members, and a banquet-style meal. And then I, as the rabbi, was to say a few words of tribute. It was clear that the organizers, prominent members of my congregation at that time, did not want the evening to be too Jewish. This was a purely secular tribute to a person who didn't regularly attend synagogue and did most of his volunteering at other organizations, but he was a good man and a member, and I was the rabbi. I might only see him twice a year, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, unless he skipped one of them, but I still had the responsibility to connect this fundraising gig with Judaism and my synagogue. I think the time I was allotted to do this on the hour-long program was listed in bold as Rabbi Kohan Talks, 2 minutes. I've never spoken long at such an event. Nobody wants a sermon or even a radio show monologue at a tribute dinner, and I didn't that time. But when I finished my remarks and started to leave the podium, I noticed something was amiss. The honoree was clearly distressed. The organizer rushed up to me, grabbed my arm, and whispered in my ear, "He wants to know what happened to the blessing." So I reascended the dais, called him and his family up, and asked everybody to rise, and I lifted up my arms, shaping each hand into the form of a shin, symbolic of Shaddai, that most ancient name of God, and I chanted and intoned those ancient words from the Book of Numbers, "May God bless you and keep you." And the honoree's aggrieved countenance relaxed, and things were better. I had given him his blessing. Looking back, I know why I was so surprised. The whole evening was devoid of religious feeling or ceremony, really, from the free-flowing cocktails at the opening reception to the jazz played by a hired band to the lame jokes and less-than-moving speeches and tributes during the program itself. Then, suddenly, it became clear that being blessed mattered very much to this successful but apparently religiously uninvolved man, and that the rabbi had to be the one to give him that blessing. I'm still not sure that a Kohen, a priestly descendant, or a rabbi, or any religious figure has a special power to invoke the deity or bring divine favor or somehow schlep God into an uninterested room in a unique way. To me, God is always present, and God's blessings flow when we work to make them happen. But there definitely remains something in many people's consciousness that testifies that being given a blessing by a rabbi or clergy person of another sort is special, a sacred gift that only religious figures can offer. I guess in a sense, I hope they are right, and I am wrong. To play us in this morning, a past guest of Two Jewish, Matis Yahu, sings his song One Day, a kind of messianic vision of peace and harmony breaking out all over the world. You know, a blessing.
Sometimes I lay under the moon. I thank God I'm breathing. And I pray, don't take me soon, 'cause I am here for a reason. Sometimes in my tears I drown, but I never let it get me down. So when negativity surrounds, I know someday it'll all turn around. Because all my life I've been waiting for, I've been praying for the people to say that we don't wanna fight no more. There'll be no more war, and our children will play. You
That was Matis Yahoo's One Day. Our guest this morning, Maxwell Greenberg, is a PhD candidate studying the history of Jewish communities in Mexico and his reflections on what Jewish Latino identity means in the borderlands between Mexico and America are fascinating and could not be more timely. Meet Maxwell Greenberg when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome the Too Jewish, our guest this morning. Maxwell Greenberg is a PhD candidate at UCLA in Latino studies, Latina studies.
Chicana and Chicano studies.
Sorry.
Adjacent.
You'll explain the difference because obviously, even though I'm from Los Angeles, that doesn't mean I understand it. And we're going to talk a little bit about what it's like to be Jewish and Latino, Judaism and Jewish identity and Latino identity. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
You clarify, like Chicano, Chicana, Latina, Latino, help us out.
Chicanx, Latinx. Sure. So, you know, the term Chicano is extremely regional, and California is certainly one of the home bases of the term. Chicano used to be a derogatory term, kind of pre-1960s.
Does it come from Chico, like an insult, kind of like a boy?
No, it comes from, actually, I think it's evolved from the term Mexica, which is another regional term for Mexican origin person, but that's in the Nahual language, I'm quite sure. But it was used as a derogatory term towards Mexican Americans pre-1960s, and you know, in the realm
Cesar Chavez and the whole identity, the Chicano identity.
Yes, yeah, so in the realm of the 1960s and civil rights, there was a reclamation of the term, and so the Mexican American community kind of reclaimed that term. Chicana, Chicano, Chicanx is much more recent as a term of empowerment, and so it's specifically about a Mexican origin experience, but in the United States.
I'm sure there are many American Jews who don't realize that there are Jews in Latin America. I don't happen to be one of them, but tell us a little bit about what it's like talking to people about that. How do you explain that? I mean, the truth is there were Jews in what we think of as the Spanish Empire in the 16th century, you know, maybe that sailed with Columbus, so long identity.
Yeah, that's exactly kind of how I pitch my research when I say, oh, I study Jews in the U.S.-Mexico border region. And that's a pretty frequent response is, you know, either I didn't know there were Jews in Latin America, I didn't know there were Jews in Mexico. I specifically studied Jews in Tijuana, Baja California. And so then the thought of Jews in Baja California is really peripheral for a lot of people. And my response has, like most responses, has evolved over the years, kind of moving through feelings of frustration and, you know, the underlying kind of elitism and ignorance that I feel underpins that question. But really, I think what's at play is that these categories of Jewishness and Latin Americanness or Jewishness and Latinidad have actually been separated over a long, long period of time. And starting with what you said, the Spanish colonial period. So Jews have been in the Americas since the start of the Inquisition. Well, the Inquisition started in New Spain in 1521 or 1571. Don't quote me on that.
No, it was 1521 because I think the first auto de fe was in the middle of the 16th century. So it had to
Perfect.
Be before that, right?
Thank you. So
cheerful subject.
Yeah. So my pitch to my project is always not only were there Jews in the Americas, but actually the border region is one of the earliest sites of settlement for Jews in the Americas. So the center of power in the New World, at least in kind of Northern America, was Mexico City. That's where the Inquisition was based. It also had spots in Cartagena, Colombia, and Lima, Peru. And if you were a converted Jew, you know, converted to Christianity,
converso,
a converso,
right.
And you converted to Christianity under the Inquisition, but you continued to practice in private and maintain some sort of Jewish ritual, commonly known as crypto judío, crypto Jew, or a secret Jew. Some folks refer to themselves as anutzim. Marrano is also a pejorative term for a practicing Jew under the Inquisition. And the border region was farther enough, you know, contemporary border regions, so American Southwest, northern Mexico, was far enough away from the center of power in Mexico City that there were still economic opportunities, specifically in and around Santa Fe, New Mexico,
right, right?
Because there was a mission there. So there was economic opportunities, but there was also relative autonomy and space for religious freedom and refuge if you were trying to practice a religion that was illegal under...
Like Judaism, like Judaism.
Like
right.
Judaism or
Protestant
Islam.
Christianity or Islam, right.
Yeah,
or Protestant. We will explore this in much greater depth with Maxwell Greenberg when we return in just a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in the Catalina foothills and northwest Tucson, celebrates its first services, classes, and events this summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha is located at 3001 East Skyline Boulevard throughout the month of June on the northeast corner of Skyline and Campbell across from La Encantada. Services, classes, and events are open to all. Join us Friday night at Skyline and Campbell. Shabbat services are at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning Torah studies at 9 a.m., followed by Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me leading them. For more information about Congregation Beit Simcha, to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, and rich array of summer adult education academy courses, go to www.beitsimchatucson.org, BEITSIMCHA Tucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me in the newest Jewish community in southern Arizona at its exciting beginning. The Tzofim are coming to Tucson. Israel Scouts are nearly here. Each year, Tucson has the privilege of hosting the Tzofim Friendship Caravan. They bring a taste of Israel with Israeli scouting, combining the talents and energy of 10 talented teenagers. The show's free, the energy is high, and you'll feel like getting up and dancing. It's this Thursday, June 20th at 7 p.m. at the Tucson Jewish Community Center. Everyone is invited, and did I mention that it's free? Special meet and greet takes place prior to the show for scouts in uniform from any scouting organization. Welcome to come at 6:30 p.m., an up-close and personal joining of the USA and Israel in the true scouting spirit that Tzofim this Thursday, June 20th, 7 p.m. at the Tucson Jewish Community Center. We are pleased to continue our recurring feature on Too Jewish called Three Truths My Grandmother's Talmud Told Me. Three Truths My Bubby's Talmud Told Me. What business is a yenta in? Yours. There comes a time in every man's life when he must stand up and tell his mother he's an adult. Usually this happens around age 45. And finally, never, ever take a front row seat at a bris. Those were three truths my Bubby's Talmud told me from Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or akfel, please email us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at TooJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website. Streaming us from there, downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the recent trip you led to Morocco and Spain, catching up on the Jewish community and the Jewish places in Morocco. You know, Marrakesh is such a mind-blowing place, if you're from the West, to me anyway, I have to say. It's an extraordinary place altogether.
In many ways. And it's either the second or third largest and most active Jewish community left in Morocco after Casablanca. And possibly Tangier. It's hard to say. What's interesting in Marrakesh is that geographically, the community is bifurcated. A certain percentage of the Jewish community still lives in the old Melach, the old Jewish quarter. And there's at least one historic synagogue there that still functions and that has no trouble getting a minyan on a regular basis. They invite everyone Saturday morning before services to a kind of pre-service kiddush, but it's not wine and cookies, it's tea, sweet Moroccan tea with mint. And then you sit in this very historic room that's probably 400 or 500 years old. And they gave the youngest member of our group an aliyah. And he was so moved by this that he's an academic. He's a professor at the Duke University campus in China.
Yeah.
So he made what for him was a very significant donation. He put a $100 bill in their box.
Right.
It was all very touching, and they invite everybody to stay afterward for lunch, and that's a thriving center of Jewish life, as it always was. There is also, in the so-called New Town, which was built really by and for the French when they were exercising their protectorate.
Their colonial control, be more accurate.
So there's a synagogue there, and a lot of people who are, let's say, maybe less traditional live there, but there's also a kosher restaurant there called Dar Ima, which is a combination of Arabic and Hebrew meaning mom's house.
Yeah.
And we went there for lunch on Friday and watched as literally dozens, many dozens, possibly over 100, prepared orders of food were shipped out via courier to Jewish guests in various hotels in town who wanted to order kosher food at least for Shabbat. And the restaurant is not open during Shabbat, they had to get it in advance. Now, how they were going to heat it up or what they were going to do with it, not my problem.
Right.
But the possibility exists. And obviously, enough Jewish tour groups come to Marrakesh to make this really a thriving business. The father of the woman who owned it commutes between New York and Marrakesh, and somebody else between Paris and Marrakesh. It's a very international, modern, clean place with kosher wines from all over the world. You could get kosher wine from Santiago de Chile if you wanted it.
Yeah.
So that was impressive. And I don't know that I would describe that as a growing community, but it's certainly not a dying community either.
Fascinating. And Marrakesh, I think I told my story a few weeks ago about finding the last shofar maker in Marrakesh.
Right.
I mean, there is still Jewish life and some vitality. And of course, so many Moroccans going back to visit.
Right.
I think that keeps it, Moroccan Jews, I mean, going back. Fascinating place. Thanks, Tom. And next week we'll talk about Spain.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Benny the Shadchan, the matchmaker, goes to see Abe, a confirmed bachelor of a certain age. Abe, you mustn't wait too long. I have exactly the woman you need. You only have to say the word, you'll meet her and be married in no time, says Benny. Don't bother, replies Abe. I have two sisters at home. They take care of all my needs. That's all well and good, says the matchmaker, but all your sisters in the world cannot fill the role of a wife. I said two sisters, Abe answers. I didn't say they were mine. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. We welcome our Shin Shiniot, our young representatives of Israel. Not as young anymore. You're growing up. Oh, my goodness. Rotem Rappaport and Ron Benekon. We're joking around too much. We've been doing this for almost a year. Welcome, Booker Tov.
Booker Tov.
And Mazal Tov.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So what am I congratulating you on? It's the fact that here in America, you each have had the privilege of becoming bat mitzvah. So tell our listeners, because here in America, most people think, oh, bat mitzvah, it happens when you're 13. They're all girls do it. That's not how it works in Israel most of the time, is it?
It's a little bit different. So where I grew up, I don't think any of my friends, like the girls, had a bat mitzvah where she read the Torah. Like, we don't read the Torah. And also we did, like, most of us had like a party or like a gathering with friends, something nice, maybe like a trip to somewhere. But that was when we were 12 and not 13. Like, for example, my bat mitzvah, I had like a celebration with some of my friends and my family. And it was when I was 12. So excited.
By the way, that used to be common in America because the understanding was that girls developed in some ways sooner than boys. They were more mature. I am not sure that's always the case. And now it's pretty much shifted to everybody doing it at 13. But still, not chanting from the Torah, not chanting a Haftarah, not interpreting. Rotem, what's your experience of this? It's kind of, you weren't involved originally, right? You got drafted by your friend Ron.
Yeah.
Take her with me.
Yeah, we're going to do it together. Actually, the idea at first kind of scares me because I'm not used to it. Just like you said, like my bat mitzvah was just a party. Most of my friends, like all of my friends just had a party. The girls. So the idea kind of like scared me a little bit because I don't know how it goes. And when I went to like guys' bat mitzvah, I was just waiting to throw like candies, not really listening to what they were saying. So I don't know like how.
By the way,
it's
that's how most kids are here too. I should hate to tell you.
Oh yay! So I wasn't like really familiar with the process of what to do and stuff like that. So the idea kind of scared me a little bit. But I'm sure it's going to go great, and I'll try my best to do the best that I can.
It's going to be great.
I wouldn't worry too much.
No.
So the one thing that I think you probably are both going to do pretty well, and that they wanted to teach you so much, is to read Hebrew.
Yeah, I think we got that part covered, you know.
So, you know, the whole idea that of when you become an adult in Judaism, which is at 13, I guess, you know, in some ways at 12, but really it's taking on that religious responsibility. It's so funny that you've had that experience here in America, right? And not something you would have really had in Israel had you stayed and gone into the army and did the regular stuff.
Right. This is why.
Yeah, it's...
By the way, you should get a lot of presents. Tell everybody they need to give you just... they can send it to us, care of Two Jewish Radio. Mazel Tov again.
Thank you.
And now a word of Torah. This week, our portion, Bahalotcha, from the book of Numbers, is filled with incidents and events from the wilderness days, as well as a couple of important commandments. It's in this week's portion that instructions are given to create the first menorah, the seven-branched candelabrum that has become the most enduring symbol of Judaism. It's also here that we get the first rumblings of rebellion that will explode into full-fledged revolt against Moses and Aaron in just a few more weeks in the disastrous story of Korach. But most significant in this week's Seder is a peculiar little story about gossip. Moses has married a new wife, and his brother and sister, Aaron and Miriam, don't think much of her. They begin to talk about her and about Moses behind his back, circulating rumors and gossip. She's not the right ethnicity. They don't like her influence on Moses. She probably laughs inappropriately or wears her hair too long. The response by God is swift and decisive. Miriam, although oddly not Aaron, comes down with a dread ailment. Moses' siblings realize the error of their gossiping ways. They repent and are healed. But the point has been made. Gossip and slander are among the most destructive influences in society. If we don't avoid them, we will indeed have tsoras, trouble, and heartache. If we can avoid them, we have every chance to build a society of joy and holiness and goodness. It's a great message today. As the Talmud teaches, gossip injures three people: the speaker, the listener, and the subject. It hurts the person who gossips, the one who listens to gossip, and the person who is gossiped about. All are morally damaged by the experience. No one benefits. Circulating rumors, sharing personal information about others, accurate or not, is not the way to create genuine community or intimacy. Lashon hara, the unethical use of speech, is attractive to many of us, but it is wrong and destructive. There are many other things to talk about, all more valuable. A famous dictum says that great minds speak about ideas, smaller minds speak about events, and the smallest minds speak about others. May we learn from our portion that the best way to use speech is to build and heal and learn, not to engage in gossip. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Maxwell Greenberg, will tell us all about Jews and Latinos and the kind of combined ethnicity that exists in the borderlands and in Mexico. A fascinating subject. Learn more about it when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Ryan Braun now holds the record for most home runs ever hit by a Jewish Major League Baseball player. The 35-year-old Milwaukee Brewers outfielder passed Hall of Famer Hank Greenberg last week when he hit his 332nd career homer in a game against the Pirates. A former MVP, Braun now has the Jewish career mark. Although he may hold that record for most homers by a Jewish player, Ryan Braun is not exactly the idol that Hank Greenberg was. Hank Greenberg, famous for not playing on Yom Kippur long before Sandy Koufax made that same important Jewish choice, Greenberg hit his 331 home runs during a career interrupted by his service in the U.S. Army in World War II. He missed 4 full years of his prime serving in the China-India-Burma theater. Hank Greenberg won 2 MVP awards as a ballplayer and was a proud pioneer for Jews in public life, in spite of having to weather nonstop anti-Semitism throughout his career with the Tigers and Pirates. Hank Greenberg was the Jackie Robinson of Jews in baseball before Jackie, and when Robinson came up with the Dodgers, Hank Greenberg was a big supporter of his. Shirley Povich, the longtime sports columnist for the Washington Post, once wrote, "Hank Greenberg was the perfect standard bearer for Jews. Hank was smart, he was proud, and he was big." Ryan Braun, who spent his entire career with the Brewers and holds the team's all-time home run record, tarnished his own reputation in baseball. After testing positive for banned performance-enhancing drugs in 2012, Braun lied about his use of them and then lobbied fellow players to support his falsehoods. Braun actually has been caught twice for steroids and using PEDs. Braun is the son of an Israeli father and has said he is proud of being Jewish. Fool said I, you do not know. Silence like a cancer grows. Hear my words and I might teach you. Take my arms and I might reach you. But my words like silent raindrops fell. David Draiman, the Jewish singer of the chart-topping hard rock band Disturbed, called Roger Waters ridiculous for promoting a cultural boycott of Israel. Disturbed, which has sold millions of albums and recorded an amazing cover of Paul Simon's Sounds of Silence, is set to play in Israel for the first time July 2nd. Boycotting a whole society and entire people based on the actions of his government is absolutely ridiculous, he said in a video interview on the Bring Disturbed to Israel Facebook page. I don't see boycotts happening of Russia. I don't see people boycotting China for what they're doing to their Muslim population. It's just Israel that gets this treatment, and I think we all know the reason behind that. Draiman added that Roger Waters, the former Pink Floyd frontman and poster child for artists boycotting Israel, and his Nazi comrades, quote-unquote, are pushing an ideology based on hatred. Draiman, known for his guttural yells and tremendous voice, grew up attending Orthodox yeshiva in Chicago, but he was expelled from 3 of them. At one point, he trained to be a chazan, a cantor. These days, Draiman sits on the advisory board of the Creative Community for Peace, a nonprofit that aims to counter Waters' Israel boycott narrative. I've been planning this literally my entire life, Draymond said of the upcoming Israel concert. The BDS crew know well enough to not even try to contact me. Whisper in the sound of silence. On its official Facebook page, the Polish Soccer Association described its team's victory over Israel as a pogrom. Mind you, Poland has an excellent national soccer team ranked far higher than Israel's. Such a victory is not at all unexpected. But to call it a pogrom if you're Polish? The term harks back to centuries of massacres perpetrated against Jews in Poland and, of course, throughout Europe. The term appeared on the page of the Polish Football Association following a Euro qualifiers game in which Poland beat Israel 4-0. This is a pogrom, winning over Israel 4-0, the update read. The word was removed shortly after it appeared. In the English-speaking world, the word pogrom is closely associated with anti-Semitic violence. In Poland, it is sometimes used as well to describe other forms of violence. Relations between Poland and Israel have suffered since the introduction of a law in Poland last year, making it illegal to blame the Polish nation for Nazi crimes. That triggered a crisis with Israel, which argued it limits research and free speech about the Shoah, the Holocaust. This dispute has escalated to include acrimonious exchanges between the leadership of both countries, including over restitution of property stolen from Polish Jews during and after the Holocaust. And now a soccer story heightens the feeling that there's something wrong in Polish-Israeli relations. And in sad news, the great Jewish music publisher and ethnomusicologist Velvel Pasternak died last week. His Tara publications made Jewish sheet music and recordings available to cantors, choirs, and music directors, accompanists, young people, everyone in the world of Jewish music for decades. His pioneering work on Hasidic music, his willingness to publish a broad range of Jewish music in usable, practical collections, helped the Jewish world sing and play for 50 years. He was a highly knowledgeable, good man who respected copyrights, helped many a fine Jewish composer and arranger reach a broader audience. He made Jewish music better all around the world through his work. Those of us who love Jewish music especially will miss him. Zecher Tzadik Livracha, may Velvel Pasternak's memory be a blessing. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome our guest this morning, Maxwell Greenberg. He's a PhD candidate at UCLA in Chicano and Chicana Studies and an expert really on the border region and on the Jewish identity within the border region between the Latino world and the Anglo world. We started talking earlier about kind of the history and why so much crypto-Judaism or secret Judaism existed, say, around Santa Fe and New Mexico. There are still many conversos and people rediscovering their Jewish identity. But it wasn't just New Mexico. There was also some in Arizona, what today is Arizona, and California. And the area you study, which was Mexico, which is today Mexico, but just south, like Tijuana. Tell us a little bit about those communities, how they evolved, and how they then sometimes came out in the open.
Sure. So there's kind of sparse Jewish history in Tijuana and in Baja California in general until the 20th century. And that's largely because you can look at the history of the railroad as part of that. The railroad actually didn't connect Baja California to the rest of Mexico until 1968, I believe, was the year when the railroad arrived there.
Well, of course, I mean, it's kind of a long string of lands separated by sea, not so easy to connect.
Absolutely. So, yeah, if you wanted to get to Baja California from Mexico City, you had to go up through Arizona, cross into the United States.
San Diego and then go over.
Yeah, and then cross back into Mexico. So, you know, given your documented status, that could be a really challenging trip. So the kind of the first Jews start to emerge in Baja California in the late 19th century when under the dictatorship of Porfirio Diaz, he was a dictator in Mexico for 31 years, is really touted as bringing a lot of quote unquote modernization and industrialization to the northern part of the country. And the way that he did that was really incentivizing European and American corporate investment in those regions to taking over mining, agriculture, urbanization. Of course, it goes without saying that all of those projects would contribute to displacement of native peoples and absorption of their land. So we see both of those processes going on simultaneously. The first kind of Jewish immigrants to Baja California, some big names, Louis Mendelssohn, Max Bernstein, and David Goldbaum. David Goldbaum actually goes on to be the mayor of Ensenada in the 1930s. These are kind of like the VIPs of in terms of Jewish history in the Baja California region. And they're all at certain points in their life involved in the mining and agricultural industries in the region. In terms of their Jewishness being visible, not so much. I think their last names would probably be read as European and foreign. They certainly were much whiter in complexion to the largely mestizo and then Chinese, Japanese, and indigenous populations in Baja California. And we know that Louis Mendelssohn specifically had a really vibrant Jewish life in San Diego. He was actually the rabbi of the temple in South San Diego. It's in downtown San Diego. The name's escaping me. It's one of the oldest synagogues in San Diego. And, you know, I like his story because it's a real story of the borderlands. You know, he has this kind of economic life in Mexico and he has his religious life in the United States. And that bifurcation between, you know, your ethno-religious identity and your kind of professional commercial identity being split between two countries is something that really can only happen in the border region.
So
yeah, that's kind of early 19th century Jewish history.
Into the 20th century,
and
right?
Then into the 20th century.
So this influx was kind of early, well, part of the industrialization and the economic development and displacement that took place in that period. The 20th century is turbulent in Mexico. It's turbulent many places, but particularly in Mexico, first half of the 20th century. No doubt also in Baja California and in Tijuana. And yet the Jewish population grows.
Tijuana's urbanization really kind of explodes in tandem with prohibition in the United States. Tijuana becomes kind of a receptor for Americans trying to circumvent the Volstead Act in 1920. And it really responds to this thirst for alcohol, which was no longer allowed for sale.
Prohibition leads to the development of large Jewish population
of
in Tijuana.
Exactly.
Okay.
And
large, but a population in Tijuana.
Yeah. So this is it's still very small at this time. This is the 1920s. So it's the tail end of the Mexican Revolution. And there's a lot of economic opportunity. The Mexican Revolution actually provided a lot of economic opportunity for folks at the border because you could kind of, if you had no allegiance to either the United States or Mexico and you are a peddler, you know, there's a lot of military people who are in need of goods. So if you were kind of a dry goods peddler, you could be selling to the Mexican Army, you can sell to the United States Army. If you had experience in kind of working in garments and military uniforms, you really had a large market in the border region. So kind of this is not specific to Tijuana at all. That, you know, look, El Paso, Juarez, Douglas, Agua Prieta, Nogales, those were all really areas ripe for kind of first generation Jewish immigrants who were peddling goods during the Mexican Revolution.
You know, it's funny because I know this area of Arizona and the city of Nogales was originally called Isaacson, Arizona, because it was a little earlier. It's in the 1880s, where he set up a shop. He set up a big tent that crossed the border so he didn't have to pay duty either way on goods. You know, if the wrong customs people came in, he'd just move it to the other side of the store. At least that's the story that I hear. And, you know, he was really founded the town. And then when he moved back to Detroit, they changed the name to Nogales. But using the border as an economic engine, this is not a new concept.
Not at all. I think that's what really is at the heart of Jewish history in the border region in a way, because we hear a lot about the border as an impediment to all types of mobility for folks. And that is certainly the, you know, 99% of the experience for people at the border is a major impediment and it separates. There's a select, very elite portion of the population that is able to use the border as an economic opportunity. And Jews have predominantly fit into that really select group of people who have been able to use the border as a business. So it's just certainly part of the history from what I've found. So the Jews don't, and getting back to the Tijuana region,
right?
The kind of influx of Jewish refugees to Tijuana who are trying to get into the United States really starts in the 1920s. And this is in tandem also not only with certainly prohibitions going on, but it's with, on a global scale, it's when the quota laws begin in the United States. So 1921 is the first national quota, and then they really get tightened under the Johnson-Reed Act in 1924. So there's a small Russian Jewish refugee population in Tijuana that kind of crops up at that time, and folks are not trying to stay in Tijuana. They are waiting for their visas to be processed to get over to the United States. And so estimates on the Jewish population at that time are almost non-existent because folks are really waiting to cross. And whether or not they were there during the time of a census, it's kind of undetermined. That's going to come into my archival research. So if you have me back on the program in a few years, I'll be able to give you a better estimate.
Okay,
but I don't think it was too many.
It's a promise, but still not large. Was there a synagogue in Tijuana in that period? Do we know?
So that's exactly what I was getting to next. So the first kind of intentional congregating of Jews on record happens between 1945 and 1947. These are all based off oral histories. Folks are quite old in these oral histories, and their memories are a little bit inventive, but that's the point of oral histories. We take people's memory as truth with lowercase t. And so somewhere in late 40s is the first kind of congregation of Sephardim, Ashkenazim, really kind of mixed together in somebody's house in downtown Tijuana on Calle Revolucion, which is still to this day the main tourist district in Tijuana. And it was hosted by the Swed family. The Sweds were first generation immigrants to Mexico by way of New York, by way of Syria. So these are Aleppo Jews.
Wow. Halabi.
Yes. And they invited, apparently they went around for weeks. Jack Swed, the kind of patriarch of the house, with another friend, went all around Baja California and I think parts of Western Sonora, literally looking for Jews to bring in for the high holidays.
Right.
In I think 45 or 46.
So just after World War II.
Just after World War II. So yeah, of course, after World War II was the second kind of wave of Jewish refugees landing in Tijuana. Again, the quota laws are still in effect. So
they can't quite get to America. They can't get there directly.
Right.
So the community continues to develop after that. Some of the people just stay because some people usually just stay. And then it grows. I mean, Tijuana has grown from what was then kind of a dusty little town to a big city.
It's called Rancho de Tijuana, yeah. And now it's certainly a major city, the port, the San Ysidro port of entry, which gets you from Tijuana into San Diego County, is the most cross-border crossing in the world daily. So it explodes really in the 80s with NAFTA, as NAFTA kind of starts to roll out. And the maquila industry under NAFTA.
Maquiladoros and all that, right? Okay. Mm-hmm.
So there's two communities that kind of form in the late 40s, early 50s. The Magen David, which is predominantly Sephardic community, and the Hatikva community, which is the Ashkenazi community. Both never really exceed 50 families, and that's a generous estimate. And at some point in the 60s, they converge to make what was called the Centro Social Israelita, which was functionally a synagogue, Jewish community center, and Jewish day school, all combined into one. Yep.
Let's talk a little bit about Jewish identity, Chicano identity, Latino identity, Chicana, Latina identity, because I think people are surprised still, even though here where I live in Arizona, many people speak Spanish, it's common, but the idea that there's some complicated aspect of that when really it's been around for 450 years. It's so interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that really motivates my work in this surprising way.
Not to mention Jews lived in Spain for 1,000 years before, well, 1,000 years nearly, 700 or 800 years anyway, and had a huge and highly developed civilization in which they spoke,
their own language. I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, Ladino is central to Jewish history.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and I think you're touching on part of my story, which is I have no Latin American heritage at all, but I started speaking Spanish at the age of 15 and have been, after probably age 17 or 18, have been functionally fluent. And the response is always, wow, you're a Jew who can speak Spanish. That's such a crazy coupling. And when two parts of your identity kind of exist inside you, it never sounds crazy. It's just who you are.
Yeah.
And, you know, my understanding of why that's been a surprise has really evolved over time. And I think it's, you know, what I've landed on and what I spoke about on this recent trip to Tucson and specifically at the Jewish History Museum recently is the way that Latinx or Chicanx or Latin American identities have been racialized and the way that Jewish identity has been racialized. And they've been racialized in very different ways, so that coupling them feels surprising to people. And what I've landed on that's kind of ground zero for the way that Jewishness starts to get racialized as white really goes back to the colonial period. You know, you'll look at Jewish scholars, and especially from the United States, or Jewish American historians will say, oh, post-World War II is when quote-unquote Jews became white. But I would say that when Sephardim come over during the Spanish colonial period as conversos or crypto-Jews, they have access to whiteness even then. And that's because when Sephardim are coming over to the Americas, yes, they were being othered and subjugated because of their ethno-religious identity in Iberia alongside Muslims, but in the Americas, they're being racialized alongside Afro-diasporic and native peoples and some Chinese peoples as well. So they become not Jews in the Americas, but they become Spanish. They become European and therefore functionally white, and they're able to occupy different tiers of the socioeconomic structure. So that is kind of pairing Jewishness with a racial identity that's really tied to Europe and tied to whiteness and tied to power. And we can trace the ways that kind of Latin Americanness has been tied to African diaspora, indigeneity, and Spanishness. But there's a mixing that Jewish identity has kind of been resistant to. So we're talking about, you know, Latin American, Latinx, Chicanx identity being racialized kind of in the context of Iberian, Native, and Afro-diasporic histories, whereas Jewish identity, kind of since it's existed, or the Jewish subject existed in the context of the Americas, has really singularly been tied to Europeanness, whiteness, Spanishness.
So they could succeed and be deeply involved at the highest levels of society in a way that others couldn't necessarily, even though they weren't the same, they weren't Catholic.
Correct. But not without the threat of getting
sent to the Inquisition.
Luis de Carvajal, he...
Kind of a serious threat.
Yeah, kind of a serious threat. You know, and it's all based on hearsay, you know, and kind of no, I think that's the kicker is no one was safe.
Right.
There was no real way to prove any of this. It was all based on hearsay. But, you know, a good example is Luis de Carvajal. He was the governor of Nuevo León, and he wasn't himself, historical records show that he wasn't himself a practicing crypto-Jew, but he had relatives who were conversos, crypto-Jews, who were practicing some very loudly. His nephew, Luis de Carvajal El Mozo, famously went to the Inquisition, and we actually have access to his memoirs that he wrote in the Inquisition cell. The Inquisitors gave him pen and paper to write letters to his family members who were also imprisoned because they wanted to read them to see if he was going to expose any other secret practices.
Wow.
Yeah, so that's really incredible to be able to access these documents written in the 16th century. That makes historians very excited.
I'll bet, and creeps out the rest of us. I want to thank Maxwell Greenberg for a great visit here on Too Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about Jewish and Latino-Latina identity?
That's a great question. It's a very early growing field. I would say if for the nerds in the audience,
yes,
I would look up Latin American Jewish Studies Association. There's also a Crypto Jewish Studies Association that's probably based in Albuquerque or somewhere in New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And
not so crypto anymore.
Not so, I've exposed them. And I guess I would just say look out for my name in any publication.
Max Greenberg, just follow his writings. Thank you so much, Max.
Thank you so much.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us on Too Jewish this morning with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guests on Too Jewish will be members of the Tzofim, the Israeli scout troop touring and performing throughout the U.S. right now. They'll be at the JCC on Thursday at 7 p.m. Our playout this morning comes from an a cappella trio singing a version of Mi Chamocha, Who is Like You, God, among those who are worshipped. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.